The Midweek Drive Team, four words which signify quality and all that's best in audio entertainment.
Time for more movie thoughts, reviews, and royal commentary from Richard Fitzwilliams and Natasha Wanton on The Midweek Drive.
An hour of television can change everything.
Three women and a whippet. Wouldn't have seen that in a BBC studio when I started.
The allegations surrounding Jeffrey Epstein include his friend Prince Andrew.
Sam,
let's start pushing the palace.
I want it for us.
You're chasing a story that we're never going to get.
This is the work.
My job is booking the people we can't just call up.
Hello, everyone.
You have a problem that won't go away.
We're looking at options. But there is a red line.
I've never been smuggled into a palace before.
If I do an interview, the question is, why you?
With respect, you know how people see you.
Spell it out.
Randy Andy.
With respect.
Everything's changed. The FBI are raiding Epstein's home. You can't stay silent. South drawing room, two chairs, 6 feet apart.
It's like a Western. Make no mistake, if we don't get the tone right, the story won't be him. It'll be us.
Your Royal Highness. Tomorrow night, in an unprecedented interview, we will hear from the Duke himself.
You know, I thought that all went very well.
All across the world, every paper, on every news channel, this is the story.
Go away!
This is only going to get bigger.
This interview, does it matter?
Yeah, it matters.
Well, we certainly would say that it's always Richard Fitzwilliams and Natasha Wanton. This time round, and we presume it's not time zone challenges, Natasha's with us and we're waiting for Richard to drop into the sequence. Who knows? Natasha, welcome back to your own slot on the Midweek Drive, Morning Edition, of course. And I shall quote, actually, Royal commentator Richard Fitzwilliams, who said there was no question that Scoop, which, of course, is a film which he wasn't actually down to review, but I feel, given the Netflix line that has been taken on this, it's yet again, how can Netflix milk even more out of the Windsor family? They've done it, obviously, with The Crown. Now, in the gifts that keeps on giving, we've actually got Scoop that's very much to the fore there. So I will quote from the Daily Express. Royal commentator Richard Fitzwilliams said, there was no question that Scoop would put more pressure on the palace over its relationship with Andrew. He told the Daily Mail, it is very embarrassing for the palace and simply another indication that Andrew is completely unfit for the royal family he was born into. The person we see in this film doesn't seem to be in touch with reality. This was the most ghastly interview from any public figure I can remember. Of course, the curious thing is, what is the Daily Express and an article written by Emily Ferguson and Jan Disley actually doing, saying what Richard Fitzwilliams is saying to the Daily Mail? I thought they were kind of competing papers. Maybe that's another world entirely. But Richard, as I say, surely the gift that keeps on giving. I mean, isn't it wonderful that Prince Andrew is back in the saddle, juxtaposed, of course, with that comment from yourself in this piece from the Daily Express? We see that he's happily smiling in terms of the way forward. And indeed, even Gillian Anderson, the star of Scoop, said that she feels it's a miracle that members of the royal family are able to retain their sanity. So if Gillian Anderson can say that, surely it's a case of come back, Andy, all is forgiven.
I'm touched, Alex, by your plea, and indeed I'm sure that that will reverberate in palace walls, but I'm afraid. I mean, one of the things with Scoop, it was very good. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I think that Sam McAllister, who was the interview producer, felt very strongly that with no pay rise afterwards, no promotion afterwards, she felt
and to be played by Billy Piper, for goodness sakes.
I know. And I have to say that one of the flaws of the movie was that, frankly, it was perfectly obvious that Sam McAllister, at least to me, that Sam McAllister had written I suspect, or had, shall we say, a hand in a good deal of that script, because it did show her in a heroic light, as well it might, because she was, after all, largely...
Don't rain on her parade, Richard.
I won't. I there was a page in the Telegraph about rumours that people who work for Newsnight, where the interview, of course, famously appeared, felt she'd
taken... Two Women and a Whippet. That could have been a much better title for it. Two Women and a Whippet.
Well, I have to say, I mean, this is a torture, but it was worth going through watching the original the night before, and you really have nothing to compare with that. But, I mean, it was interesting to see, and I think a lot of people will find it interesting to see how something as bizarre as that actually was put together and how it happened. The problem, or main problem, Keely Hawes plays Amanda Thirsk, Prince Andrew's devoted personal assistant, and that was, well, one of the most meaningful moments in it is just before the interview. She tells the prince to be himself. Now, that is precisely what he was. That was the trouble with it. And without going through the entire thing again, which I'm sure that we all remember, not only no remorse for the victims, which above all was the
Look,
most...
Look, he can easily confuse not being able to sweat. It's a condition that clearly he was actually under experiencing. And of course, the pizza restaurant in Woking. These are classic lines that will go down in history.
They will, in fact, historically, I think, you know, in 100 years, in 50 years, perhaps more, PR...
Good news there, Richard, no vomiting, no bodily fluids, and no dropping of the F-bomb. So for me, it scores an 8 already.
I say you're impressed by the absence of those things and therefore you're scoring it up. No, I have to say that I think Rufus Seale is, I've seen him as Charles II. I think he was pretty good as the strange character who was living in some sort of weird time warp. I mean, it is a...
They even got his teddy bear collection right. The fact that he gets obsessed with having his many teddy bears arranged on his bed appropriately. And if you don't get your teddy bears arranged in the right order, woe betide you.
Now, that's a very serious point, and it's a point that looks into the, well, into psychology, as one should, in a way that, in fact, gives you a good insight into his character. I agree with you, Alex. I mean, I think the fact that the bears kept appearing as well, like, honestly, I mean, you were dealing with someone who lost...
Fundamentally, we all like to appreciate a bear. But at the end of the day, whether it's a bear or a hedgehog, it's important that that bear is appropriately delivered. And you can't, you know, even our own bears won't actually get confused about where they want to sit. It's important.
Well, it's very important, and I agree with you there. And I would, in fact, it's a significant statement, Alex. But we must also mention Gillian Anderson as Emily Maitlis. Now, it's perfectly clear for anyone looking at the film that the relationship...
Dana Scully and the assistant from Doctor Who's Christopher Eccleston and David Tennant era, Rose Tyler, in the same play. Fantastic.
Well, you've also got, playing Margaret Thatcher in The Crown. I did feel that there was a very definite frisson between Emily...
and her Whippet.
And Sam McAllister. And I think that might be explored a little more when the second film, A Very Royal Scandal, which will have Michael Sheen and Ruth Wilson in the principal roles as Prince Andrew and as Emily Maitlis, where Emily Maitlis is the interview, where she's the executive producer, so that will be interesting. But no, I think a very sort of 7-8, that I thought it was pretty good. I think it's fascinating how something as bizarre as that, and the fact it happened in Buckingham Palace, don't let's forget. I mean, it's quite extraordinary. The
Queen Emily Maitlis being smuggled into Buckingham Palace.
Smuggled into? Well, I have
her
to
own
say...
words. Her own words, Richard. She said, "This is the first time I've ever been smuggled into a palace."
Well, her words may well be what she said, and I think it gives us an idea behind this extraordinary episode, and the fact that Andrew's team first approached Newsnight hoping to give a bit of puff for his charity work, and then subsequently when pitch the palace, and then Epstein was rearrested and sentenced, committed suicide, or so it was said, and then Ghislaine Maxwell arrested and so on. And the pressure then became intense, and with, of course, with Victoria Roberts Jeffrey as charges against Andrew. I think that was, I mean, very clearly the reason they thought they could change it. It's extraordinary. Princess Beatrice, his daughter, appears in the meeting that sets the whole thing up. Mm-hmm. That
taking notes.
Yes, well, the notes that should have been taken was the fact that there was no way he could possibly participate in anything outside naval activities. He was in the Navy over 20 years. He was a brave pilot in the Falklands.
He was a hero. He was Randy Andy.
Yes, indeed, indeed. And Miles Andy. But he is finished when it comes to the court of public opinion, and I'm afraid that the constant reports, and they're back again today and yesterday about some form
come back, Andy, all's well. Just leave your teddy bears behind.
I fear even with the bears, and you're quite right, Alex, again, I say this to stress the importance of those bears. They came up a lot, of course, in the film. I'm afraid even with the bears, he's had it. He'd never get back to royal duties, patronages. He's lost his military titles. He can't use his HRH, so no.
Well, shocking news there. Sarah Huntley, did you actually catch Scoop on Netflix, or have you decided after Harry and Meghan, frankly, I just don't know how much more joy of the Windsor family I can take, other than maybe actually going for Sue Townsend's classic novel from the 1990s, The Queen and I, in which a Republican government is elected to the British Isles, and basically they're all packaged off to a council estate.
Objection, Alex. May I point out that the Queen thrives in the council estate?
I reckon she would.
Yes, I think she would as well. I totally agree with Natasha. Well, you know my opinion. If it's anything to do with the Queen or the current king, or the others, yes, I'll watch it. Those lot, I won't be bothered giving my time to. Thanks very much. No.
It's a little bit surprising that we didn't see any sign of Meghan or indeed Harry in Scoop, but I suppose that's for another time and another sequel, really, which clearly will be written as we speak. Natasha, obviously in the Republic of Australia, is Scoop something which you think, yes, clearly we'll be accessing this on every Netflix channel we can find?
It's getting a bit that way. Although I will be honest, I think public opinion has been somewhat swayed by obviously Catherine's very sad announcement recently. That's featured very heavily all over the place here. That's been very big in the news. A lot of sympathy and outpouring of support for her, which has been really lovely to see. I've not actually really seen much of Scoop sort of talked about here, which is why it's interesting to discuss it on the show. I will definitely be having a look. I will probably be watching it from behind various cushions as it gets more and more cringy. But I feel like it's one of those
Natasha,
things
as
where
I
when
said,
you're watching
no vomiting, no use of the F-bomb. It gets an 8 from me.
Well, with recommendations like that, Alex, I can't not watch it, can I really? But no, I probably will be looking into it. I sort of caught the first half of an Andrew musical over Christmas, about Christmas a year or so ago, which was utterly ghastly. And but the masochist in me was kind of like, I couldn't look away. So I probably will watch this one as well. Just because it gives you a bit of an insight, I suppose, into sort of current affairs, and not in terms of like factual, but just the public opinion and the whole kind of societal outlook. And it'll be interesting to sort of break that down.
I shall probably be using it as evidence with our third year journalism students at the University of Lincoln when we actually talk through journalists on screen. I'll juxtapose it with Citizen Kane and Spotlight, because I feel it's in that particular category.
it's almost worth flying back to the UK to just sit in on that, Alex, to be honest.
Well, you know, a mother's instinct will take us to all sorts of things, as Sarah Huntley would clearly attest to, because clearly the whole notion of not one, but two Academy Award winners, Chastain and Hathaway, Hathaway and Chastain, involved in a somewhat curious psychological drama of motherhood and such like. Richard, what do you make of mother's instinct?
Did you ever see a lassie, a lassie, a lassie? Did you ever see a lassie go this way and that?
Theo? Theo!
When Theo was born, I couldn't even hold him. Okay, I was afraid I was gonna drop him. I'm a terrible mother.
You're a wonderful mother. And a wonderful friend.
I just want you to be happy too.
Max? Max, get down, it's not safe. Max! Celine! Alice?
Did you ever see a lassie go this way?
Yep.
Max is gone.
It wasn't easy bringing you into this world. Now you've left it too soon.
Go this way.
You need to separate the grief from the guilt.
What guilt, Alice?
Something's broken inside of me, and I need you.
I saw the look in her eyes. She thinks that I should have saved her son.
Is that coming from her or you?
You think I'm imagining things?
We're not going down this path again.
You're right. God knows I can get carried away sometimes.
Can Theo come over for a little bit?
It's amazing how quickly you forgot my son.
Our son. It helps me to spend time with Theo, but it helps him too.
Do you miss him?
Celine's my friend.
Get off the balcony!
Alice, this room. Did you put Theo on that balcony to test me?
Do you think I'm capable of that?
She wants us to pay for Max.
You're just accusing me of being some kind of monster.
You're losing touch with reality.
Leave my family alone!
I'm not imagining things.
Well, firstly, Alex, I was looking forward, obviously, to seeing two actresses I very greatly admire. In fact, I think you've remarked in the past that I'm very fond of Jessica Chastain, I believe. Yes, I was looking forward to
it.
Not
quite in the same league as Keira Knightley, of course, but there we are.
Oh, that's true. How right you are there. Well, my goodness, I haven't seen Keira in quite a while, actually, so maybe she'll reappear in something soon. But as a bit of a thriller, a psychological drama, here's the problem with this. It's got a first-class cast, but it's in the script that there's a lot of contrivance. And it's interesting, it's set in 1960 in suburban America. You have Alice, played by Jessica Chastain, and Celine, played by Anne Hathaway, and their spouses, who don't count, quite honestly, for that much. A lot of men don't, as I've been commenting in films these days.
Yeah, but Richard, we've already had the patriarchy for 2,000 years. It's time we packed in, basically, and handed over. So just deal with it. You know, that's a fact.
It's just a fact. As again, you correctly say, we must agree too much, but there it is. So you've got these two strong women. Or how strong are they? Are they perhaps one of them, both of them, very, very brittle to me, because when there is a tragedy that occurs early in this movie. Now, one of the problems here is that you have, of course, the sense of the 1950s where you had, as I said in 1960, that where women did appear something like Stepford wives. And one of the problems with this movie is that characters who in their time would have been well behaved and worn hats and been very formal, but it would have been natural to them, they do tend to look like, so to speak, almost like dolls. It is such a weird decade. It's a long time ago. And you look at a movie like this and you think, thank goodness it is. Yes, indeed, it was a patriarchy. But there are bits, and this is where the movie comes apart a bit, there are bits that feel throughout this film are very false.
But Richard, surely any sisterly bond is going to be taken to task when you've got guilt, suspicion and paranoia there. This is the height of the Cold War.
I'm afraid guilt, suspicion and paranoia is they're features of this, because what happens when initially, Alice stages a party for Celine, and then tensions between her and her husband, Simon, played by Anders Danielsson-Lai, are obvious. And the next day, Max, who is Celine's son, is sick from school. And then Alice sees him on a porch, and what he's doing on that porch is pretty dangerous, and she shouts out and rushes into the house to alert Celine. But unfortunately, it's too late. He falls to his death, and that starts all sorts of strange things. And you're beginning to wonder which of the two women, or possibly even both, but it's unlikely, isn't it, are paranoid and are, well, falling in psychologically, definitely in decline. And here you've got Celine, very, very... Well, both characters, you see, are beginning to suspect both. Now, here is the problem. At the funeral, at Max's funeral, Theo, who is the son of Alice, is very upset. And why? Because his toy rabbit is put in with Max's body. Now, I mean, something like that. Why was that done? And indeed, why is Celine taking every opportunity to chat to Theo? They seem very unnaturally close. So, of course, Alice is very, very, very worried. But is this reasoning reasonable? What about Celine's husband, Damien? He, after Max's death, he's more or less a nonentity and just takes to drink. And then, of course, Simon, who's Alice's husband, well, his mother said some pretty unpleasant things about her neighbour, and then she falls over, she keels over and dies. Now, is that natural? And so on. You're starting to ask all sorts of questions whenever anything happens. Theo is allergic to peanuts and has a near fit at Celine's house, and so forth. There's a certain amount of tension that develops here, and both actresses, I think, do the job extremely well. On the other hand, when Theo appears on the porch that Max fell from, where obviously, you know, you feel that somebody's seen The Innocents with Deborah Carr, based on the Henry James novel, you're getting situations. This is directed by Benoit Delhomme, and it's his first film. And this does weigh down a lot of it, because I was interested in the way it developed, and certainly you get your money's worth at the end if you want, shall we say, a little mayhem. But on the other hand, I'm not sure that I was very convinced in the way we got there. The script is a real problem here. It's had very mixed reviews, because it's a movie of mixed merit. It has got two very good performers in it. And I mean, both husbands, insofar as they matter, and they don't a great deal, perfectly adequate. But,
So is Mother's Instinct more primal or basic then, Richard?
Well, it's one of those curious movies where I came up with very mixed... mixed responses. Reviews have been mixed. I think that if you are fond enough of the two leads, then you would see it. But as I said, there is this contrivance, this falsity, that it's a bit sclerotic. There's plenty happening, but how convincing is all of that? And both as neighbours, well, possibly, yes, I mean, not bad. The monstrous patriarchy of the time has made women perhaps the way you've got two women dominating the movie, the way they were, that would be stretching a point. Certainly at the end, it would be stretching a point, but, you know, quite good.
Mm. He's probably going to go for a six. Sarah Huntley, your thoughts on this particular thing, Mother's Instinct, one for yourself, or is it a case of you can't possibly actually put in that cuddly toy into the coffin?
Well, that's very curious. That's the most interesting thing from it that Richard said so far, I think. I mean, they're two very good actresses. Is it that the cuddly toy represents some connection with the deceased boy, with a sibling he didn't know he had, or was he not the sibling child of the mother? You know, I've got my Agatha Christie.
Are they secretly Egyptians, and basically they're being buried with their possessions to take to the next afterlife?
True, true, very true. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that one, Alex. So I think it would be one to do when it's on with the ironing. I think that's the way I look at it.
Natasha, one for the ironing, or is it a case of, well, I don't do the ironing, I hand that over to my husband to do?
I love you, Sarah. You're just like my mom, and I mean that with the biggest compliment ever. It was just such a lovely mom thing to say.
I knew we bonded ever since you told me about the crying. I can't remember which film that was, and I went prepared to take a very big thank you to your
Great Escaper.
Oh yes, I mean it took. I had to have a facial after that to get over that one. Yeah.
But no, I'm in two minds about this one. I think Sarah's ironing comment probably holds true. I'm somewhat disappointed because you see the casting and you think it's going to be electric. You think it's going to be really good. But I'm somewhat disappointed by Richard's commentary about the scripting, because as we all know, if the script is not up to standard, I really get annoyed with movies fast. And it's interesting what Richard's saying about the falsity as well. And do you feel like, Richard, that's because of the scripting, or do you feel like it was anachronistic, or do you feel like there was some other problem that led to the falsity, or was it just the script?
It's a script. It's the whole way that this movie was set up. I think you're meant to be on tenterhooks to try and work out who is the most paranoid of the two, if both are, and also the various clues scattered around. But also odd things happen, like the problem that Theo has with peanuts, and that is an allergy, and that he's in Celine's home, and she's very fond of him. Why then does he end up in hospital? What was the purpose of that particular episode? Or was it to turn us off, which I suspect, without giving any spoilers, from a couple of clues as to what is going to happen here? Well, you know, it's not a bad movie. It's got two very good performers. But one keeps saying that, and what I should be saying is that they both have a chance to shine in something that really, really grips you. And I didn't feel that.
So you feel like it's more that it's been heavy-handedly done then, like in terms of what, yeah, okay, that's, yeah.
Many balcony appearances, you wouldn't get that. That happens both to Max, who falls, and then subsequently to Theo, and there's absolutely no way that any mother would do other than, well, just about crack up at that, which happens, but it wouldn't... The idea is that Celine allows, or appears to allow, this to happen with her neighbour's son after her own son fell from the self-same balcony to his death. This is silly. And if you put it in a movie, you get the likes of me feeling that, you know, that the script is, it's got ridiculous scenes in it.
Well, whenever you have anaphylactic shock or peanuts, as we found last week with, of course, the occupant, you've obviously got challenges with respect to that. So any peanuts that actually emerge in that long day's journey into night with Brian Cox and company, or is that a case of no, it is a peanut-free zone?
Well, I have to say, Long Day's Journey is. I mean, I've seen David Suchet's version, Jeremy Irons, and now we've got Brian Cox and Patricia Clarkson. It is a truly great play written between 1939 and 1941 by Eugene O'Neill, autobiographical, desperately painful, electrifyingly so he stipulated in his will, though his wife didn't follow his request that it shouldn't be staged for 25 years. It's set in the summer in 1912, and we have Brian Cox, and he again he plays a pretty brutal, loving to be sure, but also a deeply complex patriarch. He's an actor. He's an actor who's known enormous success, but also a failed actor because of, and this is brought out in dialogue that's amazing. The fact that he knew extreme poverty as a child and has never, essentially, the character is still in deeply, deeply tied to this terrifying upbringing where there was hardly any food to eat and so forth. So, I mean, he'll sit there with one light bulb on, somebody who's never owned property and been responsible for endless speculator deals. He's never given any stability to his wife Mary, and tragically, she is an addict. That is the problem, a morphine addict. When you see the play and you find out why, and also somebody who, and Mary is a portrayal by Patricia Clarkson. There's a problem with it, as I'll come to in a second, but she cannot accept that her son Edmund, which is also an autobiographical, is linked to Eugene O'Neill, who had tuberculosis. She can't accept that he's a consumptive, and there's a lot that she can't accept. And of course, the characters in this two children, the children of James and Mary, James Jr. and Edmund, and they're constantly, everyone else is to blame for the various predicaments that the family finds itself in, except whoever's speaking. The father, it's Brian Cox is superb at patriarchal roles, as anyone who's seen Succession, and I mean, that was just amazing, will testify. And also, the diction is wonderful. Cox inhabits the role. It's well worth seeing for him, not to mention an extremely fine performance by Lawrie Kynaston as the consumptive. He's about to be finally diagnosed by his doctor, and then subsequently, the father intends to save money by putting him in a state sanatorium. Eugene O'Neill's experiences. It's well worth reading the background to all of this. Darren McCormack as James Jr., a failed actor, someone who's an alcoholic, spends his
A lot of
time in
failed
prison.
actors in this one, Richard. A lot of failed actors.
Well, but the tragedy of James, played by Brian Cox, is that he was an enormous success. So much so that the public would only accept him in one role, which caused, according to one critic anyway, a certain amount of mirth because Cox has played in both the patriarch in Succession and here. But there is one problem with this production, really, really a difficulty. And that is, I was in the circle and I couldn't hear a word Patricia Clarkson said, or hardly a word. And that simply is very, very unfortunate because
Maybe her microphone wasn't working, Richard.
I fear that, whereas from the physical point of view, she enacted the part perfectly adequately. And so I could see, but I couldn't hear. And that it really did mar a good deal of it for me, quite honestly. I mean, it is also, just to mention, it's 3 hours 20 minutes. So if you want one of the finest plays ever written in America, certainly a family drama like no other, it's well worth seeing. But I do think it'll have done with a bit of trimming. And yes, I mean, it's fascinating, but I do like to hear, and it was a very, very unfortunate director,
Couldn't you
Jeremy.
lip read, Richard?
No, I can't, Alex.
Yeah. Okay, Sarah, one for yourself, Long Day's Journey tonight, or is that just 3 hours of your life you didn't wish to actually give up for this?
No, I think I will go and see it. I have to say this weather has rather been getting me down. So I need to go and see things which are...
It's swimming in sewage off the southwest coast that gets you down.
Well, that's what I'm doing every day, actually, and getting work done down here. Not quite that, though. Not quite that, Alex. I'm trying to bring you the Cornish daffodils, as you can see. I think I'd go. I'm intrigued by the fact that some people aren't... Don't get me on my voice projecting. I mean, that is just ridiculous. And... Is it going to get to the point, am I just getting a silly old fart? But I mean, basically, for God's sake, if you're an actor, you have to project. And is it that she's done too much telly and doesn't understand? And why doesn't the director or somebody say, we can't hear you at the back? Projection and energy is so important. I'm surprised.
May I interject, Sarah, that I was tempted. I was so tempted to shout from the circle, I can't hear, please.
He got love, yeah. No.
She might as well have had Parkinson's, as far as I know, the addiction. Yeah. I read.
I just think there's no excuse for that. And in other theatres, you know as an actor whether your voice is hitting where you're going. That's what I can't understand. Because if you haven't done a voice warm-up before in the half, before, it takes the voice, at least 10 to 15 minutes to know that it can reach the back of the circle and the upper circle. And in fact, I was talking, not going off point, you know me, I do, but it does have a point, is that I'm very excited to be going to see Twelfth Night at Regent's Park. And I was talking to a friend of mine, Richard Cant, who's playing Malvolio, Brian Cant's son from Flareway. And the one thing about when you go and see something at Regent's Park is they don't have mics. They only have mics for, well, they did for Le Cage aux Folles, but that was only for the singing bit. And they really do manage to project their voices brilliantly. So this is in an inside theatre. So I would be intrigued to go and see it just to see the quality of how little projection is going on, I suppose.
Well, sit near the stage, Sarah, I really would.
No, I'll get a seat in the stalls. No, an interesting concept. Interesting, again, with what Richard's told us, or I can't remember, there's Alex, that he didn't want it done for 15 to 20 years. That's an interesting one.
So that's it was too painful for him.
Oh, was that the reason?
And that was after his death as well, because obviously it would upset everyone in the family, and he just wanted an interview. But his wife went ahead, and in 1956 it premiered.
No, I'm very intrigued. I think I will go, yes.
Natasha?
I might take Richard back with me and ask him to say, we can't hear you at the back. Yeah.
Any thoughts from yourself, Natasha, in these closing moments?
I think, just in line with what Sarah's saying, if you're on stage and you're unable to get your voice, you know, to your audience, then it's kind of like, what's the point? And you would hope that that's kind of on you. But as she was saying as well, it's also kind of on your director and the people around you to sort of, you know, say that we can't hear you, and hopefully they'll speak a bit louder. But that's unforgivable if you're missing, you know, good portion of what's being said and the understanding of the narrative, the because you can't hear what's then. Going on.
Get some sign Sorry? Language. Get the performance signed so you can actually have a few people by the side of the stage who can actually sign.
It's a very important time.
Well, if it helps.
No, seriously, Alex, you've made a bit, whilst intending to be glib, you've actually made a very important point, because sign language with the character, in As You Like It, of Rosalind, the actress who played, when I saw the play, in fact, I think we discussed this some months ago, she is hard of hearing, and as a result, they had sign language, but also for the benefit of the audience, you had the dialogue in lights around the stage. And I found that, you know, I'm not deaf. I do, however, like or sometimes like subtitles when, you know, when you've got a lot of scenes where people mumble. That even on film, that can be a good deal less certain as the stage, but there can be exceptions. For example, and we'll come to this in a future week, Nachland at the Young Vic. Someone fell ill among the cast, and the only replacement had quite literally to read from notes. Mm. Now, if that happens, of course I accept that, you know, there may be hearing problems, because they can't. It's very difficult to project when you're actually in the position of reading, but I haven't often seen that.
Well, it's all too due to the thorax and the diaphragm, and we head off from Long Day's Journey tonight via Mother's Instinct and, of course, Scoop. No chance for Richards to give his viewers on Damsel, but obviously, Natasha, you shared your views on that a few weeks ago, so we'll just have to wait and see whether Richard is in the Millie Bobby Brown fan club or not, as far as Damsel is concerned. Still, we can look forward to the joys of King Kong versus Godzilla, or Godzilla Kong, which I think you're doing next week, Natasha. And who knows, maybe even that little look ahead to the Biden presidency and the Trump presidency, the postscript, of course, with Civil War, the latest Alex Garland movie.
Alex, I'm trying to see it, so I'm hoping perhaps I might get to a preview. Otherwise, we might have to deal with a film you might have a lot of problems with, because I certainly did on one level, and that's Monkey Man.
We don't have anymore. tiger burning bright. Deep in the forests of my night, you are the one who keeps me strong. Silent cooling streams down in the darkness of my dreams. All of my life I never knew you were the dream I'd see come true. You are the tiger burning bright. I was the one who looked so hard I could not see. Now I could never live without the love you give to me. I live like a wild and lonely soul, lost in a dream beyond control. You were the one who brought me home down to earth. For you are the tiger burning bright, deep in the forests of my night. All of my life I never knew you were the dream I'd see come true. You are the tiger.
Gifts in wills. Have you thought about the process? Have you thought about maybe paying it forward? Well, over the next few moments, we're going to consider the way in which you could actually look to save lives simply through actually adding some funding to that will, as we're talking about legacy funding, specifically with reference to some recent research by Cancer Research UK, who actually pointed out that around a third of respondents with a will say they do include a gift to charity. And to talk us through some of the aspects of this and the importance of legacy giving, we're delighted to welcome Cancer Research UK Head of Legacy Giving, Sam Devlin. How are you, Sam?
I'm good, thanks, Alex. Thanks for having me on today.
Excellent. Now, there is, of course, a line that if we were talking about this half a century ago, we might have been saying, well, why should we actually give money to something which is going to actually lead to death in any case? And we know there's only two certainties in life, death and taxes. But actually, survival rates when it comes to cancer are improving. And that's really coming about because of the amount of research that's going into cancer as a particular challenge in our human experience. And obviously, to do that, we need to have finance.
Yes, that's right. So we're so grateful to our supporters of the past, really, that have helped fund a lot of the research that's happened in the last 50 years. So we have seen survival rates double with cancer over the last 50 years. So it is no longer a death sentence. Many more people than ever before are living with cancer. It is still unfortunate that one in two will be affected by cancer in their lifetime. And obviously that means that everybody ultimately is impacted by that, because it's not just the individuals themselves, but family and friends as well, who go through that whole journey with their loved one. So it's really important that we're funding the vital research today that can help future treatments and better diagnoses in the future.
We're seeing this, of course, most recently with, of course, the royal family and two members, obviously, going public with their cancer diagnoses and so on. Does that actually help issues such as this? Is it something which gets people to think about the whole process and maybe some ways in which they might be able to help?
Yes, I think certainly the recent, any sort of prominent figurehead who has their own cancer experience really does bring it home to individuals and the general public, really. It's like cancer has definitely resonated with the public consciousness in recent days and weeks. And I think it makes people sort of reflect on their own situations and what we always say is, you know, if you do find anything that doesn't feel quite right or you're uncertain, then to check it out with your local GP.
There are lots of competing demands on people's finances and so on. Everything from obviously Cancer Research UK right the way through to animal charities, lifeboat institutions and so on. Why in particular is Cancer Research UK such a valid consideration for people who might sort of have kind of be thinking about the whole process, but actually might think, yeah, actually, I need to find out more. This is why I'm going to give a legacy to Cancer Research UK.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really valid point. Everybody has their own personal reasons for supporting individual charities. And gifts in wills often gets overlooked as an option. As you say, it's not an out-of-pocket expense. It's something that it's a way that you can donate after you've passed on. And really, it's the support that and the research that we fund. So Gifts in Wills actually funds a third of the work that Cancer Research UK does. So it's a really, really important income stream for us. And it really helps us plan in advance. So knowing that somebody has pledged to leave us a gift in their will really helps us plan for the future and look at what particular research projects we want to invest in, and then also kind of trials that we can look into to help the wider population.
There is, of course, one challenging fact, Sam, that goes very much alongside this. And so far as it's all very well talking about legacy gifting and so on, but 60% of people apparently don't have a will, which also rises to 40% of the over 55. So I suppose the first thing is you need to actually take out a will to start off with.
Yeah, that's right. Unfortunately, it's another piece of life admin that we never quite get round to, but it's hugely important that this is formally documented, like your wishes are formally documented in a will, either with a solicitor or an online provider. There's lots of options these days, and it's actually not as complicated as it might seem. On our website, we've got quite a lot of information, and you can also sort of put in your postcode, and we can recommend a local solicitor that we work quite closely with who can help step people through that process. But it's if that's 60% of people who did who currently don't have a will but did go ahead, like that would release a lot of funding for the whole charity sector as a whole, not just Cancer Research UK.
Life circumstances can obviously change. I was surprised to see that actually you can also update your will. It's not something that is set in stone. Once you've actually made your will, let's say you made a will when you were mid-40s, etc., you reach your mid-60s, you can still actually change it relatively easily.
Yeah, that's right. I think most people kind of write their first will when they're moving house or when they have their children. So it's kind of key life stages that encourages people to really think about it. But once it's done, people don't then look back. So yeah, a third of people haven't updated their will in the last 5 to 10 years, and a lot can happen in that time frame, whether you've moved house, grandchildren might be on the way, or you know, circumstances really can change, and it's actually a lot simpler to update a will than to create a new one.
In terms of actually ensuring, one of the questions that often people ask of all charities, that the money goes directly to research as opposed to that wonderful system which is called admin, does Cancer Research UK actually have procedures in place that effectively are transparent and open so they can say, yeah, I'm making a donation to Cancer Research UK, I want to make sure it goes there?
Absolutely. So we are the largest funder of cancer research in Europe. In fact, Only the US government funds more research than Cancer Research UK. So just our scale really enables us to minimise the administration costs to as much as possible. And as part of our duties as a charity, we really need to maximise all the income that comes through, particularly with gifts and wills. And we actually have to prove that to the Charity Commission that we're maximising any gift that's left to us towards our cause.
And is it simply a case of typing Cancer Research UK into your search engine and taking the link to you from there? Or is there another website?
So cruk.org.uk/giftingwills will take you to the specific part of our website, which provides people with plenty of information and in layman's terms as well, and kind of helps people on those first steps.
Excellent. Sam Devlin at Cancer Research UK, Head of Legacy Giving. Incidentally, Sam, what brought you to take up this particular position? Was it a personal story, or was it just a case of, well, it seems like an opportunity to do good?
Yeah, a bit of both, really. So I've had my own personal cancer experience, and an ex-partner as well also had cancer at quite a young age, and when we were in our 20s. So I've had a background in marketing for many years, and it's really a way of putting my skills to what I kind of thought was a better use than working in financial services. And I really enjoy the people I work with and meeting supporters on a day-to-day basis. It really brings job satisfaction home.
Excellent. Well, it's been great chatting to you today, Sam. Sam Devlin, Cancer Research UK, Head of Legacy Giving. Keep up the great work.
Thanks, Alex.
What a scenario without siren radio. Turn up everyone, save a siren sound.
Oh, siren radio.
Come linking to Miami, Paris to LA. Our global community wants to hear it play. Students participate, keep on keeping on, keep on keeping on.
Siren Radio,
keep on keeping on.
Siren Radio,
keep on keeping on.
Siren Radio,
keep on keeping on. Say Siren Radio.